Why? Because no mainstream journal would publish it. Bem later told me that this was the first time in his 50-year career as a well-respected academic psychologist that he could not get an article published in the same journals he had been regularly publishing in throughout his career. Why not? Because most psychologists don't appreciate how slippery the concept of time is, so they don't believe that precognition can be real. A March 1, 2017 feature story in New Scientist addressed this issue with the question, "Does time go both ways?" In the article, we learn that in quantum mechanics, where a system's evolution is probabilistic, you can specify conditions for the initial state and final states of the system, and both of these conditions will influence the evolution. Apply this idea to the universe as a whole, and information could be coming from plus infinity and propagating back through time, says physicist Sandu Popescu of the University of Bristol. There's no evidence of any of this so far, Popescu cheerfully admits. No one yet has investigated it seriously, he says. No one, that is, except for the 90 replications of Bem's experiment and literally hundreds of other experiments on precognition with positive results published since 1935. When it comes to controversial topics such as precognition, zombie myths, ideas that die hard, take on a life of their own. In the March 17, 2017 issue of the Chronicle of Higher Education, we find an article mentioning Bem as a quirky psychologist, because if his claims about precognition are true, then all hell will break loose. Bem's finding would upend what we understand about the nature of time and causation. It would be a big deal. Bem's paper, Feeling the Future, was widely ridiculed and failed to replicate, though Bem himself has stood by his results. Similarly, in a May 17, 2017 article in Slate magazine, we find academic psychologists panicking because Bem had gone to crazy land and broke science. Sigh. Perhaps someday when our super-smart robot overlords are in charge, they'll do a better job at reporting science news because they won't have hair on their shiny metal heads, and thus they won't have to tear their hair out every time an experiment challenges their naive beliefs about the nature of time and causation. If we just calmly stick with the experimental facts, then there is no question that Bem's experiment is in fact repeatable. And that means we're influenced not only by our past, but also by our future, as seers throughout history have tried to tell us. What does precognition see? Divination is often imagined to reveal the absolute future, as though the future were fixed or fated to unfold in a predetermined way. But the nature of the future isn't all that clear, nor is it obvious what precognition sees. We usually behave as though we have free will, but maybe we really have unalterable destinies, and free will is just an illusion. This raises the question, does precognition perceive the actual future, the one that must occur, or does it perceive a probable future, a future that might occur? And how can we tell which is a better explanation? By now you've learned that with a little thought it's possible to devise experiments that can explore even the most mind-boggling puzzles, including this one. We included such an experiment as a secret feature in one of the online tests at gotsci.org. This test is modeled after the famous 25-card, 5-symbol ESP test popularized by J.B. Rhine at Duke University in the 1930s. In the web browser, the user sees the backs of 5 cards. The task is to click on a card that the user thinks the computer will randomly select. After her selection, the computer shows which card it selected, along with feedback for the number of trials completed so far. It is implied in this test that the computer randomly selects the future target uniformly among the five possible cards. But that's actually not the case. There's a hidden feature. Before the web server displays the backs of the five cards, it selects one of those cards at random, call this card T1 for target 1, and then it randomly assigns a bias, B, to that card. The bias determines how likely T1 will end up being the actual target. The value of B ranges from 5%, meaning the card is very unlikely to end up as the target, to 100%, which guarantees that it will definitely be selected as the target. After the web server selects both T1 and B, the backs of the cards are displayed and the trial begins. All of this takes a fraction of a second, so the user doesn't know about the hidden feature. But now you know. At this point, the user selects which card she thinks the computer is going to select. Call her chosen target uppercase R for response. Now the web server decides whether the first card it selected, T1, should end up as the final target based on the value of bias, B. For example, say the computer initially assigns for T1 the bias level B equals 90%. In that case, T1 will become T2 90% of the time. But there's also a 10% chance that the computer will select a new target, call it T2, at random from one of the remaining four cards. The bottom line is that if the user ends up selecting T2, that is, R equals T2, then that trial is declared a hit. If R does not equal T2, then the trial is declared a miss. After collecting some 80 million trials with this hidden feature, we test it to see whether precognition tends to see the actual or the probable future. If precognition sees the actual future, which we've defined as T2, then the bias B, which as you recall is randomly assigned to a different card on each successful trial, shouldn't influence the user's performance. But if precognition sees the probable future, then when T1 is very likely to become T2, because its associated bias was a high probability, the more likely it ought to be perceived and thus selected. The relationship between B and the resulting hit rate is a statistically significant correlation of lowercase r equals 0.45, which is associated with odds against chance of 40 to 1. This suggests that precognition accuracy is influenced by the present probability of the future target. The outcome of this experiment cannot be attributed to the participants' conscious choices, because nothing reveals that there's a hidden factor. So this probabilistic influence is a completely unconscious tendency. This suggests that if we look at a subset of trials where the cards were selected by rote rather than by conscious deliberation, then we might find that the hidden biases would have an even stronger effect. To do this, we looked at trials where the user selected the middle of the five targets, which was the most common unthinking response. For those trials, the bias-to-hit rate correlation increased to lowercase r equals 0.603, associated with odds against chance of 400 to 1. And if we remove one outlier, the correlation increases to lowercase r equals 0.762, now with more impressive odds against chance of 10,000 to 1. What all this suggests is that precognitive perceptions are influenced by the probable future. It still doesn't tell us unequivocally if future events are flexible or fated, or if we have free will. But it does hint that the future is probable and not fixed. As more people begin to realize that thorny questions about time and causation can be studied in scientifically rigorous ways, and that these studies can provide intriguing results, then one day we may gain a much better understanding of what precognition sees. A disturbance in the force. The energy of the crowd is insane. 20,000 people. It's the biggest jolt of adrenaline. It's very hard to explain. You know the old story about the woman lifting the car off her kid? It's in that realm. You can actually hurt yourself and not know it. Tom Petty, in an interview with Esquire magazine. Schools of fish and flocks of birds are common ways of observing collective behavior in animals. Humans, too, are influenced by group behavior. Crowd psychology, a branch of social psychology, studies behavior in vigilante mobs, consumer fads, stock market booms and busts, and political movements. These collective, often highly contagious phenomena demonstrate that otherwise rational behavior by individuals can, depending on context, quickly devolve into destructive mob violence or remarkable acts of altruism. Theories of crowd behavior note that because we are social animals, we are exquisitely sensitive to the herd instinct and are hardwired to imitate. Here we consider another possibility related to collective consciousness. An artistic portrayal of this phenomenon was a scene in the movie Star Wars. At one point, the Jedi Knight Obi-Wan Kenobi suddenly staggers as if in pain, then says, "I felt a great disturbance in the Force, as if millions of voices suddenly cried out in terror and were suddenly silenced." This happened just as the evil Galactic Empire was using the Death Star weapon to blow up an inhabited planet. The Force was described by Obi-Wan as an energy field created by all living things. It surrounds us and penetrates us. It binds the galaxy together. The question posed by such a story is whether the esoteric concept of an anima mundi, or world soul, is a measurably real phenomenon. Within Psi research, this idea was first encountered by noticing that during participation in engaging rituals, whether sports, meditation, or music, people sometimes reported a strange, expansive feeling, as though they had merged with the group's collective mind. Such moments are described as an energetic shift, a feeling of electricity in the air, or being in the zone. The term energetic in this context is not what a physicist means when discussing the four known forces of physics, but rather what people describe as a palpable subjective sense of vibrancy or excitement, or as an unusual feeling of liveliness. This phenomenon may be similar to the concept of resonance in physical systems. Resonance can be demonstrated by placing a group of metronomes running at similar, but not exactly the same, frequencies on a flexible surface. That allows the metronomes to shift from a state of maximum entropy, randomness, where each metronome acts independently and creates a noisy cacophony of random ticking sounds, to a state of maximum negentropy, order, where the separate movements become tightly synchronized and generate a single, uniform, loud tick. From the perspective of each separate metronome, the transition from acting independently to becoming part of the collective might be felt, in an anthropometric sense, as a release of personal effort accompanied by a huge rise in collective energy. That's because it's easier in nearly any context to swim with the current than against it. As the resonance increases, a metronome might feel that it's becoming one with the collective. Previous studies investigating these collective effects, like the Global Consciousness Project mentioned earlier in this chapter, have used RNGs designed to produce truly random bits, zeros and ones. Those studies suggest that when collective mental coherence intensifies, it causes something like a disturbance in the force. An example of such an episode was the unusually contentious 2016 presidential election in the United States. Analysis of data from the Global Consciousness Project, using that project's standard method of analysis, show that the combined results of the first three presidential debates showed a modest but statistically significant deviation from chance, with odds of 330-1. But the big event was November 8, 2016, the day of the election itself. Perhaps 100 million people around the world were rapt with attention throughout the day, with nearly all opinion polls predicting that the Democratic candidate would win. But as the day lengthened and election results started to come in, the results were tipping in favor of the Republican candidate. As the election drew to a close just after midnight, Pacific time, on November 9th, and collective emotions had reached a feverish pitch, the Republican candidate was finally declared the winner. This stunned everyone, not only because most of the pollsters were dead wrong, but also because the popular vote was strongly in favor of the Democrat by nearly 3 million votes, the third highest vote count received by any presidential candidate in U.S. history. It was also only the fourth time in U.S. history that the winning candidate failed to receive the majority of popular votes. The mismatch between winning the popular vote and losing the election was due to the archaic peculiarities of the U.S. Electoral College system. To study shocking mass events like these, we developed a new kind of RNG. Instead of turning random electronic noise into bits, ones and zeros, as most commercial RNGs do, we recorded the noise itself. We did this because while RNG studies have produced interesting results, because of the way they're constructed, it's not possible to reverse engineer what happened inside the RNG during the attention-riveting events. In our new system, we recorded the noise generated by a semiconductor component called a Zener diode, a source of electronic noise used in most commercial RNGs. We constructed 32 separate devices that we called quantum noise generators, QNGs, and recorded the noise in each QNG at 1,000 samples per second. Then we ran the 32 QNGs starting one day before the election to 4 days afterward. The QNGs were powered by a battery, so the array was completely off the grid, and the data were collected in a quiet garage in a house near Lucasfilm's Skywalker Ranch in a rural area in Marin County, California. We thought that would be an especially appropriate place to see if we could detect a disturbance in the force. We looked at two measures. The first studied the relationship between successive samples of noise. This is known as an autocorrelation analysis. Truly random data shouldn't show any systematic relationships between one sample and the next. But what we observed was a visually obvious spike in the data a few minutes after midnight Pacific time on November 9th. This spike was within minutes of when news outlets around the world were calling the election for the Republican candidate. The odds against chance of observing a peak value of that magnitude within an hour of the final results of the election, as compared to all of the data recorded over 6 days, was calculated to be 226 million to 1. What this implies is consistent with the idea that when millions of minds intently focus on the same event, it causes a ripple in the fabric of space-time. In this case, it explicitly suggests a wrinkle in time, because an autocorrelation is a measure of self-similarity in time. The second measure looked at dependencies among the outputs of the QNGs. This is known as a mutual information analysis. Just as there shouldn't be any dependencies in the temporal sequence of data produced by truly random systems, there also shouldn't be any dependencies between the outputs of separate random systems. But what we see is a spike at midnight associated with odds against chance of 81,000 to 1. This again suggests a wrinkle in space-time, but in this case it's a wrinkle in space, because it indicates that the QNG devices were no longer acting like separate objects. By analogy, the QNGs were floating like a collection of buoys in the ocean. Normally, the motion of such buoys would be independent, but for a short period of time on election night, when the news media focused the attention of millions of viewers, the buoys moved together like a single object. In the context of magic, what this and other field consciousness studies suggest is that rituals designed to draw and focus the attention of a group may accomplish more than simply produce a psychological sense of group coherence. They may also, as the magical traditions suggest, literally distort the fabric of reality. Law of Correspondences. The law of correspondences is a principle underlying many magical practices. Based on the assumption of an interconnected reality, this law proposes that inner and outer experience, or mind and matter, intermingle and interact. It's the principle behind the practice of sigils and writing magic. What you sustain in your mind is reflected in the world at large. This idea, popularized in one form as the law of attraction, has been tested in psi research, primarily in mind-matter interaction or psychokinetic experiments. But it exists in many forms. Here we'll consider how it manifests in mind-body interactions, where the mind is associated with one person and the body with another distant person. The feeling of being stared at. Many people have reported the feeling of being stared at. A scenario in everyday life is when a man, typically, stares at a woman, typically, whom he finds attractive. To avoid appearing boorish, ideally the man doesn't stare like a drooling lunatic, but rather gazes obliquely from a location where he thinks she can't see him. After a minute or so, the woman suddenly looks up, as though something caught her attention, and more often than not, she turns directly toward the man and either glares at him with contempt or, if the man is more fortunate, smiles. British biologist Rupert Sheldrake's book on this topic, The Sense of Being Stared At, describes many experiments he and others have conducted to test if these anecdotal reports are due to sensory cues, peripheral vision, or a genuine psi sense. In a simple form of this experiment, one person of a pair is assigned to be the starer, let's call him Mulder. The other is the staree, let's call her Scully. They sit within a few yards of each other, with Scully's back to Mulder. To begin the experiment, Mulder flips a coin to decide if he should stare or not stare at the back of Scully's neck. If the assignment is to stare, Mulder intensely gazes at Scully for 10 seconds. Then he alerts her with a cricket clicker, a handheld device that makes a cricket sound, to respond either yes if she thinks Mulder is staring at her, or no if she thinks he isn't. Sheldrake popularized experiments of this type, some involving trial-by-trial feedback under informal conditions, such as tests conducted by pairs of children in classrooms, and under more controlled conditions, such as designs using blindfolds without trial-by-trial feedback, and under even more secure conditions, such as having Mulder stare at Scully through a window and from a far distance. In the published literature, I found 60 of these experiments reporting a total of 33,357 trials by Sheldrake and others. The overall success rate was 54.5%, where chance expectation was 50%, a rather small effect in absolute terms. But the overall odds against chance for seeing this small effect over thousands of repeated trials is a staggering 202 octodecillion. That's 2 times 10 to the 59th power to 1. This is so far from a chance outcome that it should have settled the existence of this phenomenon once and for all. But, of course, it didn't. Critics have suggested that this result is due to one or more design flaws, or even to blatant fraud. Many of the suggested flaws, like inadvertent cueing, peripheral vision, collusion, cheating, or misrecording the responses, have been tested. Some of those flaws might indeed explain a proportion of the results, but no one flaw or combination of flaws has been identified that can credibly account for the overall results, including fraud, because many independent groups have successfully replicated these results. In addition, the subset of studies conducted where Mulder and Scully were separated by windows and at far distances from each other still ended up with astronomical odds against chance. We were curious to see if we could get similar results in our lab. We used a computer to randomly assign the staring condition of each trial and automatically record the results. We ran 12 pairs of people in the test, including 5 pairs of children, ages 8 to 14. The data were collected in 31 sessions of 20 trials each. The overall hit rate was 53%, which is not quite significant given the number of trials run in the experiment, but consistent with what others have reported using a similar experimental design. We also found that after the first 6 trials in a run of 20 trials, the odds against chance were about 1,000 to 1. After the 6th trial, performance began to decline, suggesting that the participants found the test tiring or boring, so their ability to sense distant staring dropped off. The unconscious feeling of being stared at. A more rigorous form of this experiment involves isolating Mulder and Scully by both distance and shielding, and where the measure of interest is Scully's physiological condition, heart rate, blood pressure, etc., when Mulder is staring at her over a one-way video circuit, as compared to when the video display is turned off and Mulder's attention is withdrawn. Over a period of years, we conducted studies using this basic design and involving several hundred pairs of people. In our lab, Scully was isolated from Mulder by placing her inside a 2,800-pound electromagnetically shielded chamber constructed out of double-walled solid steel walls, floor, and ceiling, and Mulder was located behind a wall in a room about 20 meters away. Before we conducted these tests, we experimented with loud sounds, cell phones, walkie-talkies, and jumping on the floor to see if there were any normal ways that the two parties in these experiments could communicate. No such methods were found. One day, while testing loud sounds, we blasted a Coast Guard air horn in the sender's room and measured the sound level in the receiver's shielded room. There were no detectable changes in sound level in the shielded room when the blasts occurred, but we did accidentally summon the local fire department. We didn't realize that the sound a Coast Guard horn makes is similar to a fire alarm, nor did we know that the horn blasts could be heard 5 miles away. Among the studies that we conducted using this setup, we found that being stared at affected one's gut feelings, as measured by changes in electrical activity in the belly. We also found in long-term emotionally bonded couples, one of whom was being treated for cancer, that when the healthy partner gazed at the image of the patient, it affected the patient's physiology. We also found that if the healthy partner had been trained in a meditation technique called Tonglen, a Tibetan word for giving and receiving, which focuses on cultivating and sending compassionate intention, the patient had a larger and more sustained physiological response. Meta-analysis. As noted earlier in this chapter, a meta-analysis of laboratory experiments involving pairs of participants who were strictly isolated and where physiological measures were used to detect distant staring showed strong overall evidence that this effect was real. German psychologist Stefan Schmidt, who conducted the meta-analysis, conservatively concluded, "The existence of some anomaly related to distant intentions cannot be ruled out." Many of these studies were conducted in the usual abstract, white-coat, emotionally neutral manner. Such experiments have the advantage of being able to safely study aspects of human behavior and performance, but they also have a disadvantage, namely, that the dispassionate design is unlike real life. It is especially unlike the provocative rituals and extreme motivations often involved in magical practices. But that doesn't mean experiments can't use more alluring designs. Voodoo. In the 1990s, Dutch researcher Rens Vezelman was a visiting scholar in my lab when I was at the University of Nevada. Rens proposed that we use a magical principle to try to enhance the outcome of a feeling of being stared at experiment. We euphemistically called the study a test of a traditional magical healing ritual, but it was really about voodoo. The term voodoo comes from voodoon, an Afro-Caribbean religion that originated in Haiti. Formed from a mixture of West African traditions and Roman Catholicism, it shares the magical belief in the law of correspondences. In this case, the correspondence under test was the relationship between an effigy of a person and the actual person. To begin, each of us molded an effigy of ourselves out of Play-Doh, a modeling clay. Around the effigy, we put personal belongings, messages, nail clippings, bits of hair, and whatever else we felt would make the effigy alive. With the effigy, we included our own photo, a watch or other object we'd habitually carry, and a one-page autobiography. During the experiment, again calling the sender Mulder and the receiver Scully, we had Mulder kindly gaze at the Scully doll and mimic giving it a neck or back rub. We explicitly prohibited sticking pins in the Scully doll or doing anything spooky to the doll that we wouldn't normally do with Scully herself. We wanted to discourage the cliched negative connotation of voodoo and encourage the feeling that the doll was the distant person. Mulder and Scully were located in rooms on different floors of adjacent buildings, separated by about 100 meters, with several concrete walls and a staircase between the buildings. There were no electronic connections or other means of ordinary communication between the rooms. Scully was located in the receiver's room, wired up with a physiological monitor to continuously record her heart rate, electrodermal activity, small changes in the activity of her sweat glands, and blood volume pulse, a measure of blood flow, in one of her fingers. To begin a test session, the experimenter synchronized Mulder's laptop computer with the computer used to collect Scully's physiological data. Then she gave the laptop and the Scully doll to Mulder and asked him to go to the sender's chamber in the building next door. This was a dimly lit, acoustically and electromagnetically shielded chamber. Black fabric was placed on the walls and the ceiling of the chamber, and the effigy and other ritual objects were placed on a black cloth on a small table in the center of the chamber. A candle on the table was the main source of illumination. A laptop computer was also on the table. It was used to present instructions to Mulder. The idea of this eerie-sounding setup was to create the stereotype of a magical ritual space. After settling in, Mulder started the instruction program on the laptop. Meanwhile, the experimenter started to record Scully's physiology and waited quietly until the session was over. Mulder prepared for the session by reading Scully's autobiography, gazing at her doll effigy, and trying to make a mental connection with her. During the intentional influence periods, Mulder used any mental strategies that he thought would help Scully to calm down. They included sending nurturing thoughts toward the doll or the photographs, or mentally massaging areas over the doll where Scully said she was especially responsive to relieving stress, like the shoulders or the back. Play-Doh is a soft material, so we thought it best not to handle the doll itself, lest it fall apart. Each session consisted of 10 intentional influence periods and 10 resting periods, each 1 minute in length. A counterbalancing scheme for the influence and rest periods was used to avoid biases due to natural cycles and drifts in physiological states. The laptop program in the sender's chamber instructed Mulder when it was time to influence Scully, to relax, or to prepare for a change in instructions. It also indicated when the test session was finished, upon which Mulder left the ritual sender's chamber and returned to the lab where Scully and the experimenter were waiting. A single session in this experiment took about a half hour from start to finish. Three sessions were usually completed in a day, with the three participants, sender, receiver, experimenter, taking turns in each of the three roles. Incidentally, all of the individuals in this study, as in all of our experiments, understood the point of the experiment, all agreed to participate, and all were free to opt out of the study at any time and for any reason. Results. The results indicate that Mulder's intention period successfully influenced Scully's physiology. Her fingertip blood volume increased significantly, and her heart rate decreased significantly. Each of these measures took about half of the one-minute influence period to reach its peak deviation from the baseline. Both of these changes were consistent with a relaxation response, because an increase in fingertip blood volume means the capillaries in the hands are dilating, associated with warmer hands and a blushing response, and heart rate slows down when relaxing. However, the modest rise in electrodermal activity was unexpected. Normally, when a person relaxes, electrodermal activity progressively declines. It doesn't increase. So this outcome, a sort of relaxed arousal state, was puzzling. Still, the bottom line was that controlled use of a magical technique caused two measures of physiology to significantly change in ways that were unexpected from a conventional perspective, but in alignment with the law of correspondences. We repeated the same experiment with two new participants and a different physiological monitoring system. We ran a total of 16 sessions, and as in the original experiment, the results again showed that blood volume pulse significantly increased and heart rate significantly decreased. But this time, electrodermal activity also significantly increased. The successful replication provided confidence that the experimental technique had worked, but it also increased our confusion about why electrodermal activity increased, and in this case, significantly so. To investigate this puzzle, we asked each participant to describe how they had interacted with the effigy doll. It turned out that in this study they rubbed the shoulders of the dolls to give the patient a remote massage, and they all also stroked the hair and or face of the dolls. That is, unlike in the first experiment, they touched the effigies. Based on the law of correspondences, we speculated that what we were seeing in Scully's physiology might be similar to what happens in the human body during an actual hands-on massage. So we measured what happened physiologically when one member of our team directly massaged another member's shoulders and stroked his hair. We ran a session using the same timing and measurements used in the voodoo experiment. What we found was that during the actual massage, electrodermal activity increased, heart rate decreased, and blood volume increased. In other words, this was the same pattern observed in the voodoo experiment, suggesting that during the ritual, the actions and thoughts of the distant healer were indeed mimicked in the patient, as though the healer and patient were actually touching each other. In the first experiment, the doll wasn't touched, which may be why the electrodermal activity in that test did not rise as much as it did in the replication study. This test suggested that psi research could benefit by paying closer attention to magical principles. However, I also felt that adding voodoo to our experimental repertoire would be sociopolitically explosive, so we didn't try it again. One can push the envelope only so far in a university setting without causing administrators to faint. I've met a few who were tough and capable of withstanding the heat generated by controversy, but others? Well, let's just say that they tend to spook easily. Theurgy. Theurgy involves communication with disembodied entities, also known as spirits, angels, fairies, phantoms, shades, and ghosts. Some magicians are inclined to evoke entities with darker connotations, known as demons, imps, gremlins, jinn, specters, wraiths, and banshees. Another type of traditional magical entity is a servitor, a thought form created to serve, hence the name, a specific purpose. In Tibetan lore, such creatures are known as tulpas. In Jewish lore, a similar mind-made creature is called a golem. These creatures apparently have a penchant for making up their own minds after a while, so they're not always benign or trustworthy. Do such spirits actually exist? From a scientific perspective, the jury is still out. Some of the ghost-busting shows on television are, like all reality TV programs, scripted and carefully edited to generate ghostly excitement, otherwise no one will watch the show. Most of the time, genuine haunting expeditions encounter nothing unusual at all. Sometimes credible investigators do report anomalous events, and I've investigated several purportedly haunted sites, including an 800-year-old castle with a long history of things that go bump in the night, and during those expeditions there were a few odd moments. But drawing firm conclusions from field studies is difficult. Fortunately, there are a few phenomena amenable to scientific study that suggest the independent existence of disembodied entities. One involves near-death experiences, the other mediumship. There are other bodies of evidence, such as stories suggestive of reincarnation, but those are not suitable for experimental work unless you'd like to volunteer and are willing to risk being reincarnated as a manatee. Disembodied minds. Nobel laureate Francis Crick, 1916-2004, famously quipped that the mind, the self-aware, subjective aspect of the brain, is nothing but a pack of neurons. Crick asserted that all mental activity, all of your joys and your sorrows, your memories and your ambitions, your sense of identity and free will, are in fact no more than the behavior of a vast assembly of nerve cells and their associated molecules. That proposal, which is now a central tenet of the neurosciences, suggests that near-death experiences, NDEs, are best understood as hallucinations caused by distortions in neural activity as the brain shuts down. No other explanation is possible because, from the pack of neurons perspective, mind and brain are identical. In that case, the NDE's visions of distant environments or discussions with disembodied entities are examples of bizarre dreams. But there are problems with the assumption that consciousness is generated by the brain. The main problem is that the neurosciences demonstrate correlations between brain activity and different states of cognition and consciousness. That is, when we look at images or we think about things, brain activity varies in predictable ways. These relationships are quite real in the sense that they can be repeatedly demonstrated, but as any student of elementary statistics will tell you, correlation does not imply causation. In other words, just because a flower reliably turns toward the sun during the day, it's not valid to jump to the conclusion that the flower is causing the sun to move or the earth to turn. As esoteric scholar Gordon White writes, "As for the contention that the brain creates these experiences and somehow emanates consciousness itself, this is entirely without proof. The brain is a dark place. It contains no sounds or colors. When viewed with high-end medical devices, the human brain will treat us to a largely unpredictable fireworks show of electrochemical reactions. But so will dead salmon when you put them in an MRI. To say these electrical signals are creating experience is to say that Rihanna lives in your radio. She doesn't." Another counter-argument to a brain-based explanation for consciousness is the observation that NDEs are reported even when the brain's electrical activity, as reflected in an electroencephalogram, EEG, has flatlined. This would seem to rule out hallucinations and dreams, because if the brain is completely inactive, then the mind must also be inactive. So NDEs could not be reported, but ipso facto, they are. At face value, this line of reasoning seems to be persuasive, but it's been challenged by recent discoveries that brains continue to show activity well below what was once considered to be flatline conditions, such as in deep coma or the dying brain. In 2013, Daniel Kroger and his colleagues at the University of Montreal reported that a novel brain phenomenon is observable in both humans and animals during coma that is deeper than the one reflected by the isoelectric EEG. The same year, scientist Yimo Borjigin and his colleagues at the University of Michigan found evidence indicating that the brain is not completely quiescent during cardiac arrest, and in particular that high-frequency neurophysiological activity in the near-death state exceeded levels found during the conscious waking state. The mammalian brain can, albeit paradoxically, generate neural correlates of heightened conscious processing at near death. Based on such findings, if NDEs consisted only of dreamlike images, then however vivid, convincing, or unusual they may seem, brain-oriented explanations could not be completely excluded. In other words, maybe all of those awesome experiences about seeing the light, speeding through a tunnel, and meeting deceased relatives really are due to brain-generated hallucinations. But hallucinations do not cover the full phenomenology of NDEs. Some experiences also include perceptions from outside the body, like floating near the ceiling above an operating table, or witnessing events happening beyond the reach of the ordinary senses. When such perceptions are verifiably accurate, they are far more difficult to explain away as brain illusions. These types of perceptions are not reported very often, but that they ever happen challenges the criticism that NDEs can only be figments of a dying brain, or that those reporting these experiences are psychologically dissociated. Other studies indicate that memories of NDEs remain crystal clear and are not embellished even after 2 decades. NDE memories are also significantly different from imagined events. At a neural level, NDE memories resemble ordinary memories of everyday events. They don't look like memories of imagined events. Dutch cardiologist Pim van Lommel summarized the state of the science about NDEs in a 2011 article in the Annals of the New York Academy of Sciences. The NDE is an authentic experience that cannot be simply reduced to imagination, fear of death, hallucination, psychosis, the use of drugs, or oxygen deficiency. Patients appear to be permanently changed by an NDE during a cardiac arrest of only some minutes' duration. Our consciousness, with the continuous experience of self, does not always coincide with the functioning of our brain. Enhanced or non-local consciousness with unaltered self-identity apparently can be experienced independently from the lifeless body. Theoretical explanations for these experiences still lag far behind the empirical data, but that's common in the history of science. Herbal preparations containing salicylates were used for thousands of years before it was understood why acetylsalicylic acid, better known as aspirin, worked. And even with robust effects that were easy to demonstrate, like magnetism, it took centuries before useful explanatory theories were devised. Given that no one knows how consciousness can arise out of matter, it isn't surprising that science has yet to provide a satisfactory explanation for these experiences. Theoretical quibbles aside, how does the existence of psi influence our understanding of NDEs? The main implication is that it falsifies the theory that reports of distant perceptions during NDEs can be due only to confabulation or coincidence. Does distant perception imply the persistence of consciousness after bodily death? In my opinion, so far the evidence is insufficient to give a confident answer. Everything we know about psi from a scientific perspective to date comes from tests involving living persons. In addition, there is abundant anecdotal and experimental evidence that non-ordinary states of consciousness, for example, dreaming, meditating, being under the influence of entheogenic compounds, are conducive to enhanced psi phenomena. Given that near death is a prime example of a non-ordinary state of consciousness, it may be that some of the strikingly vivid aspects of NDEs arise because clearer forms of psi perception are suppressed by a normally functioning brain. That is, from an evolutionary point of view, for our species to survive, we had to pay very close attention to the here and now. We need to sense the tiger stalking us right now, not a tiger 1,000 miles away or 2 weeks from next Tuesday. That evolutionary pressure made ordinary conscious awareness exceptionally adept at detecting danger, but at a cost of excluding naked reality, awareness of events distant in space or time. So when normal brain functions are incapacitated through brain injury, brain surgery, or an NDE, it's possible that the neurological and psychological filters that ordinarily prevent us from perceiving naked reality might also begin to subside. In that case, some people might report significant increases in feelings of self-transcendence, unexpected enhancements in consciousness, and improved cognitive skills. And that is exactly what happens. It doesn't happen all the time, or for everyone suffering a brain insult, but that it can happen is sufficient to counter the idea that consciousness, especially more refined states of consciousness, is completely dependent on a normally functioning brain. The largest experimental test of NDEs to date appeared in 2014 in the journal Resuscitation. In a multi-site, 4-year study, physician Sam Parnia from the Stony Brook Medical Center of the State University of New York, along with colleagues at hospitals around the United States and Britain, studied cardiac arrest patients to see how many would report NDEs. For those who did, they asked how many would be able to report awareness while their heart was verifiably stopped and their brain was flatlined. In some sites, the study also involved a shelf that held a hidden photographic target above the hospital operatory that could be seen only by someone floating near the ceiling. If a patient went out of his or her body and hovered near the ceiling and could remember seeing the target, then that would provide objective evidence that the out-of-body state was real and not an illusion. After several years, the experiment included 2,060 cardiac arrest patients, of whom 330 survived. Of the survivors, 140 were eligible for the test. They responded to the request for an interview, signed informed consents, and so on, and were subsequently interviewed. Of them, 101 completed all of the surveys and were eligible for the second phase of the investigation. Of the eligible group, 55 reported some sense of awareness or memories during the cardiac arrest. Only 9 of the 55 had experiences consistent with an NDE, and of them, only 2 had auditory or visual awareness during episodes of ventricular fibrillation. Unfortunately, both of those cases occurred in locations where the shelves and target photographs had not been placed. One of the 2 candidates could not participate in the follow-up survey due to ill health. The one remaining case, according to the article, was a 57-year-old man who described the perception of observing events from the top corner of the room and continued to experience a sensation of looking down from above. He accurately described people, sounds, and activities from his resuscitation. His medical records corroborated his accounts and specifically supported his descriptions and the use of an automated external defibrillator, AED. Based on current AED algorithms, this likely corresponded with up to 3 minutes of conscious awareness during cardiac arrest and CPR. The bottom line is that NDEs suggest that one or more of today's assumptions about the mind-brain relationship is probably wrong. A better understanding of these experiences might well find that some features of an NDE are associated with an impaired brain, but it also seems likely, given the independent evidence for PSI and other bodies of survival research, that an adequate explanation will also include glimpses of realities that are presently beyond the grasp of today's science. For a journalist's review of the evidence for disembodied forms of consciousness, I recommend Leslie Keene's 2017 book, Surviving Death. And for a discussion of NDEs from a medical perspective, I recommend John Hagen's 2017 book, The Science of Near-Death Experiences. Dead or Alive? Another line of research that probes the theurgic domain are studies of mediumship. Mediums are people who claim to be able to communicate with the deceased. Double and triple-blinded studies show that some mediums can gain accurate information about the deceased under conditions that strictly exclude all conventional explanations. Mediums' experience is that the information they've obtained comes from the deceased, but where it actually comes from is not yet certain. Some mediums claim that they can just glance at a photograph of a person and immediately tell if the person is alive or deceased. To test this claim, we invited 12 professional mediums to our lab to look at photos. All of the photos used in the experiment were first transformed into a uniform grayscale, and then the photos were counterbalanced across 8 categories: gender, age, gaze direction, glasses, head position, smile, hair color, and image resolution. For each image of, say, a middle-aged, dark-haired man who was gazing at the camera, wore glasses, and was smiling with his head tilted to one side, one photo fitting that same description would be of a living person, and another would be of a deceased person. This counterbalancing method was used to avoid giving the medium any clues about whether the person was alive or dead. The mediums examined 404 of these photos displayed in a random order on a computer monitor, one photo at a time. Each was shown for a maximum of 8 seconds. Half of the people in the photos were deceased, and half were alive at the time the experiment was conducted. The mediums were asked to press one button if they thought the person in a photo was living, a second button if they thought the person was deceased, and a third button if they didn't know. The medium's overall average accuracy on this task was 53.8%, where 50% was expected by chance. That's associated with modest odds against chance of 250 to 1. 5 of the 12 mediums independently obtained statistically significant results, and 9 of the 12 mediums obtained results in a positive direction. Besides demonstrating that the mediums could statistically discern who was alive or dead based on a fast glance at a photograph, their performance showed an unexpected outcome. We used photos of people from 3 time periods: many decades ago, a few decades ago, and recently. The medium's performance was much more accurate with the newly deceased, 56.8% correct, than with the older deceased, 51.7%, or the long deceased, 50.2%. This result, which surprised us, suggests a possible way to experimentally explore the idea of reincarnation, because mediums sometimes report that a person who passed away long ago no longer feels dead, presumably because that person, or some aspect of that person's spirit, has gone on to another incarnation. This finding was unexpected, so we'll have to see if it's repeatable in future experiments. We also collected electrical brain activity from the mediums as they performed the task. We observed a robust effect while they were looking at the photos. At 100 milliseconds after the photo was displayed on the monitor, which is before the mediums could consciously decide how they were going to respond, their brains showed different patterns of activity when they correctly decided if the person was alive or dead, as compared to when their decision was incorrect.